You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm delighted to introduce our next session here at this venue this afternoon. Greenbelt impacts us in so many ways. Our heads, our hearts, our bodies, our emotions are stirred through music, through drama, through theatre, even, yes, through Dancing in the Rain. But one of those things that makes our hearts stir is the gift of poetry. And I'm delighted that Padraic O'Toole, now unveiled, big cheer, is with us this year, not just remotely, but in the field, both bringing his own poetry, his own sessions, but also hosting this wonderful conversation this afternoon. So be prepared to have your hearts move, your minds expanded, as we enter the world of poetry and social justice.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's so nice to see you. Let me check with everybody who's here at the moment. Can you hear me? You can? Great. My name is Padraic O'Toole, and I am delighted to be in conversation today with Martine Espada. And I'm going to introduce Martine, and you, I know, will be moved by the scope and breadth and interests and artistry of his work. Martine has published more than 20 books as a poet and editor and essayist and translator. He won the U.S. National Book Award for Poetry in 2021. He's had books banned and outlawed because of their focus on justice and human rights. He is a former tenant lawyer, as we'll hear later on, from Greater Boston in the United States. And he works as a professor of English at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Martine, you are so very welcome to Greenbelt.
Thank you very much, Bobby.
I don't know where your camera is focused on at the moment, Martine, but there's about 100 people here, all in anoraks and waterproofs and umbrellas. Some, one or two are dry. Most people are not quite dry. And we will be broadcasting this as a podcast later on through Greenbelt and through Poetry Unbound as well. And you are among friends, Martine. Even if you haven't been to Greenbelt before, people are excited to hear your work. So I want to start off by asking you a couple of questions so folks can get to know you a little bit. We're going to be hearing a lot of your poems today from across four collections, but I'd love to hear first, when did you first hear poetry?
I was not raised with poetry. I first heard poetry when an eighth grade English teacher forced me to recite the lyrics of the Mikado out loud. It was not an auspicious start. So that was the first time I heard it.
And when did you think that you and poetry might have a longer conversation than that inauspicious start?
It was very gradual. I did not study poetry in school very much came to it on my own. I recall, in fact, that I was a terrible student, and in fact, once flunked English in the eighth grade, and now I am a professor of English, which Amazing. Only shows you the strange directions your life can take. Mm.
Were there early poets who you turned to that surprised you about your connection with poetry, or was it something that happened by yourself, just turning to poetry without having guides in the form of books or voices that helped?
It really wasn't until I got to college, and more to the point, dropped out of college, that I started to haunt the bookstores of Madison, Wisconsin. I would eventually get a bachelor's degree in history from University of Wisconsin. But first, I got a degree in the bookstores of that town and began to stumble across poetry and reinforce the idea that this was something for me. But even before that, there were attempts to introduce me to poetry, which in hindsight, I realized meant a great deal. When I was about 20 years old, there was a family friend, a community organizer by the name of Luis Cardena Costa, who came to visit us, and he handed me an anthology. This anthology was called Latin American Revolutionary Poetry. It was bilingual. It was edited by Roberto Marquez, a Puerto Rican scholar. I took the book with a loud grunt, wasn't sure whether to read it or to eat it, but I instead opted to read it, and I discovered that I had a tradition, that I had a history, that I had a legacy, that I was not alone. And that, if we can pinpoint one moment where it started, maybe that's the place.
Anthologies, I'm going to ask you about an anthology later on, but anthologies are an extraordinary way for people to enter into a broad field of poetry, I think.
Oh, absolutely. If you are looking at an anthology and there are 50 poets in it, and let's say you only respond to 10, well, that's 10 books you should go out and get.
Yeah, that's great. You studied law and worked as a tenant lawyer in Boston. Could you tell us a little bit about the interest in that and your curiosity and your focus on that? I'm tempted to say your fire for tenant law, because it is such an alive energy in you.
The interest, so to speak, was the interest of others. Mm. My father wanted me to go to law school. My primary mentor at the University of Wisconsin, Professor Herbert Hill, former National Labor Director of the NAACP, civil rights activist, wanted me to go to law school. Neither one of them had any concept of me being a poet or studying poetry. I was the first person in my family to go to college. I didn't have any concept of an MFA program or the idea of teaching poetry down the line. In fact, my mother once took me aside and asked me, what's a graduate student? I thought once you graduate, you're not a student anymore. Yeah. And that was the level of our approach to my future. So that's how I ended up in law school. I went to Northeastern University Law School in Boston, and I got my JD there. Mm. And I practiced in several areas, but I ended up focusing on housing law. I represented tenants with a program called Su Clínica Legal, a legal services program for low-income Spanish-speaking tenants in Chelsea, Massachusetts, tough little town right across the Tobin Bridge from Boston, gateway city, a city of immigrants, always has been.
Yeah. I wonder if we could start off with hearing poems from you by hearing The Poet's Coat.
Sure. Would you like me to say a few words about it?
You can do that now or after, as I've got plenty of questions for you, Martin, about the poem.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, simply put, this is a poem for a friend of mine, a poet and Vietnam veteran by the name of Jeff Mail, who I knew through the William Joyner Center for the Study of War and Social Consequences at UMass Boston. Mm. The Poet's Coat, for Jeff Mail, 1946 to 2003. When I cough, people duck away, afraid of the coal miner's disease, the imagined eruption of blood down the chin. In the emergency room, the doctor gestures at the X-ray where the lung crumples like a tossed poem. You heard me cough, slipped off your coat, and draped it with ceremony across my shoulders, so I became the king of rain and wind. Keep it, you said. You are my teacher. I kept it, a trench coat with its own film noir detective swagger. The war in Vietnam snaked rivers of burning sampans through your brain, but still your hands filled with poems gleaming like fish. The highways of Virginia sent Confederate ghost patrols to hang you in dreams. A black man with too many books, but still you tug the collar of your coat around my neck. Now you are dead, your heart throbbing too fast for the doctors at the Veterans Hospital to keep the beat, their pill bottles rattling maracas and a mambo for the doomed. on the night of your memorial service in Boston, I wore your coat in a storm along the Florida shoreline. The wind stung my face with sand, and with every slap, I remembered your ashes. With every salvo of arrows in the rain, your coat became the armor of a samurai. On the beach, I found the skeleton of a blowfish, his spikes and leopard skin eaten away by the conqueror, Salt. Your coat banished the conqueror back into the sea. Soon, your ashes fly to the Veterans Cemetery at Arlington, where once a Confederate general would have counted you among his mules and pigs. This poet's coat is your last poem. I want to write a poem like this coat, with buttons and pockets and green cloth, a poem useful as a coat to a coughing man. Teach me.
Well, thank you. I hope you can hear the applause from here, Martin.
I'll have to take your word for it.
This poem, as you mentioned, is dedicated to Jeff Mayle, who died when he was about 56. Many of your poems either name people of your acquaintance or friendship or mentors, or are deliberately addressed to them. And there's something, when I read your work, I always feel introduced to a community of people around you. And you said earlier on that, you know, your interest in law was about the interests of others. Could you tell us a little bit about the kind of social, almost the personal social interest that you bring to so many poems by introducing us to this, to people, including the wonderful Jeff Mayle?
Well, I've never quite heard it put that way before, but it's true. I do tend to think of poems, not all of them, but many, as providing a service. And sometimes it is quite literally having to do with a service. So this particular poem, I recall reading at a memorial for Jeff Mayle at the Joyner Center for the Study of War and Social Consequences after he died. It was very small, it was a gathering of friends and his colleagues. But that became a pattern, most definitely, for me as a poet, that I was called upon sometimes to play the role in a secular society that was classically played by preachers at memorials, to deliver the words, to say something, to make sense of what is apparently senseless, and that is, of course, death.
You know, I've been preparing for this interview for a few months, and the first time I read this in the most recent preparation, I felt my shoulders warming when you have that beautiful stanza, "You heard me cough, slipped off your coat and draped it with ceremony across my shoulders." And I was thinking it wasn't only the gesture of the coat, but also that the coat was warm from his body as he put it around yours. Like, there's the sense of touch that is not just the physicality of the coat, but it is the warmth of another, of a friend's body who wanted to warm yours. It is so intimate, this poem.
It is both a metaphorical and a literal warmth. Yeah. I should point out that at that time in my life, my primary health problem was respiratory. I was every year coming down with bronchitis or pneumonia. I did a reading in Houston with a partially collapsed lung, as I would find out later. And so some of it was damage from life on the road. Yeah. In this particular case, you're absolutely right. He quite literally took the coat off his body and put it onto mine. Mm. And the tenderness of that gesture was something that always stayed with me.
Yeah. And the way it finishes with those beautiful words, "Teach me." How is he teaching you now, as you, 20 years after publishing this poem, as you revisit it?
I aspire to the tenderness of that gesture. Mm. I aspire to that kind of generosity. I aspire to pay tribute to my teachers, and my teachers are everywhere. I'm not simply referring to the people who helped me get degrees in history or law. I'm surrounded by teachers. My wife is probably my greatest teacher these days.
This is from a book titled The Republic of Poetry, which is one of my favorite titles for a book of poetry ever. And I get a feel for your idea of the democracy and the republic idea of poetry. But I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the choice of that title for that book.
Well, that particular title comes from a collection of poems, some of which was based on the travels I made to Chile for the Neruda centenary in 2004. I had never seen an entire country not only celebrating a poet, but celebrating poetry with a capital P. It was quite extraordinary in my experience, and yet every once in a while I would run into that sense of the Republic of Poetry, where poetry was essential to democracy, where poetry was essential to being alive, in fact. And so, yes, it is a republic. It is not a dictatorship, as one critic put it. It sounds like the dictatorship of poetry, but it's very much a democracy in my view. Yeah.
The next poem I was wondering if you could read, Martin, is Heal the Cracks in the Bell of the World. You might want to give this an introduction as well.
Yes, of course. Well, this is a poem that I wrote for the community of Newtown, Connecticut, after the notorious massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in December of 2012. And 26 people were murdered by a gunman. And the vision behind the poem is not necessarily or solely my vision. It comes from an organization that was founded in the wake of the massacre at the site of the massacre in that community called Sandy Hook Promise. The idea being that we are going to now work to prevent this from happening any way we can. And then I encountered a very unusual assignment. I was asked to come and speak at a community program less than a year after the massacre in Newtown. And I realized I couldn't take the usual approach. I couldn't simply write about the thing that happened because the audience was going to consist of people who had suffered the direct consequence of this tragedy. I wasn't going to show you the bodies, so to speak. And so how do you write about something without writing about it? I decided to write about the vision instead. So this is the source of the poem, and it's called Heal the Cracks in the Bell of the World for the community of Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 students and 6 educators lost their lives to a gunman at Sandy Hook Elementary School, December 14th, 2012. Now the bells speak with their tongues of bronze. Now the bells open their mouths of bronze to say, listen to the bells a world away. Listen to the bell in the ruins of a city where children gathered copper shells like beach glass, and the copper boiled in the foundry, and the bell born in the foundry says, I was born of bullets, but now I sing of a world where bullets melt into bells. Listen to the bell in a city where cannons from the armies of the Great War sank into molten metal, bubbling like a vat of chocolate, and the many mouths that once spoke the tongue of smoke form the one mouth of a bell that says, I was born of cannons, but now I sing of a world where cannons melt into bells. Listen to the bells in a town with a flagpole on Main Street, a rooster weather vane keeping watch atop the meeting house, the congregation gathering to sing in times of great silence. Here, the bells rock the heads of bronze as if to say, melt the bullets into bells, melt the bullets into bells. Here, the bells raise their heavy heads as if to say, melt the cannons into bells, melt the cannons into bells. Here, the bells sing of a world where weapons crumble deep in the earth and no one remembers where they were buried. Now, the bells pass the word at midnight in the ancient language of bronze, from bell to bell, like ships smuggling news of liberation from island to island, the song rippling through the clouds. Now the bells chime like the muscle beating in every chest, heal the cracks in the bell of every face, listening to the bells. The chimes heal the cracks in the bell of the moon. The chimes heal the cracks in the bell of the world.
Beautiful. I am so moved by what you were saying in terms of the positioning of writing this poem, which is to say people don't need to be told of their own atrocity. They bear witness to it themselves. But that what you were doing is trying to have a certain kind of music. I'm struck by that line, the congregation gathering to sing in times of great silence. The irony, singing and silence and great. It's a heavy poem that is trying to give a sonorous music to it. In some ways, that is the task of the poet, but it must have felt like a ferocious responsibility to try to put words for that moment.
It felt impossible. And to this day, I'm not sure I did it justice. I was paying homage to their vision, to their determination to continue as a community, to continue as families, and not everybody made it.
Yeah,
but I formed some lasting relationships. In fact, there was a poet named Brian Clements, whose wife, Abby, was a teacher at Sandy Hook and survived the massacre. Mm-hmm. And she went left, the gunman went right. It was that simple. And Brian edited an anthology for Beacon Press called Bullets into Bells. This was the title poem, as a matter of fact. So it is about them. They don't need to be instructed on their own atrocity, but I had to say something about their vision.
Yeah.
And this was the way I decided to go about it.
And their vision is one that change is possible and necessary and powerfully necessary. I wonder if you could talk about change and the possibility of holding on to hope that change is possible, even when we are sometimes beleaguered by despair.
Well, it won't come as news to learn that mass shootings continue in this country. It won't come as news to learn that every now and again there's another school shooting. And yet, the activists, the organizers that came out of that community had a significant impact on the state of Connecticut. That must be said loud and clear. They changed the dialogue about what to expect of our future. And it had been 14 years. And that, in one respect, seems like a long time. And a single lifetime, 14 years, is a long time. But in the course of history, it is but the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
And so I think we must be patient with their vision.
Yeah.
It could happen.
Yeah. I think I'm right that you teach a course, or at least have taught a course, called Poetry as the Political Imagination. Are you still teaching that course from time to time?
Yes, from time to time.
I'm so intrigued by the title. I want to take the course, but B, we all want to hear about it.
Well, Poetry, the Political Imagination is a 20th century survey course of poets engaged in exactly that. And the first poet in the course, in fact, is Wilfred Owen. Mm. But then it brings us forward in terms of contemporary poets as well, with a focus on Latin America or U.S. Latinos, which just happens to be my area of expertise. And the notion is that the politics by themselves are necessary but not sufficient. Mm. The poetry by itself is necessary but not sufficient. We must find a way to bring them together. Thus, the political imagination, I think we need it.
Yeah. You edited a collection of poems 6 or 7 years ago, which was titled What Saves Us? Poems of Empathy and Outrage in the Age of Trump. Could you talk about that edited collection and the need for it?
Well, as you know, having done this yourself, it's a very labor-intensive task to put together an anthology. Mm. The permissions alone will make you tear your hair out.
Yeah.
However, I felt it was necessary to bring people together, poets in particular, to remind one another that we are not alone, that, you know, pardon the cliche, but this too shall pass.
Mm. Do you ever encounter resistance from some people that you bring poetry and politics into conversation? And what's your response if you ever do encounter that resistance?
Well, there are two basic forms of resistance. One is, you might say, academic. There is a whole school of thought out there, as you well know, that poetry and politics don't mix. So there is that. Then there are more dramatic forms of opposition, shall we say. I once got a bomb threat at a reading in Tucson, Arizona.
Wow.
I call that criticism. and in fact, it worked out for the best because the whole thing resulted in all of us gathering in the parking lot, and I read my poems under a street lamp. And then there are perhaps even more sinister forms of objection. The next poem I'm going to read, if our list is correct, would be a poem called Floaters, which came to the attention of a white nationalist website. They had some rather, you know, unflattering things to say about it and me.
Sure.
And I was on their radar, so that was some cause for concern. But gosh, yeah.
You're right, that is the next poem. It's the title poem of the 2021 book, Floaters. And you won the National Book Award in the United States for this book. I wonder if you could, because I'm not sure that folks on this side of the Atlantic are familiar with the pejorative way in which the word floaters is used, so you might need to remind people here of that. It's a slightly longer poem. It's maybe twice the length of the poems we've heard before. And as with all of Martine's work, it's extraordinary.
Well, to begin with, this is a poem for two Salvadoran migrants who came to be known by their first names. It's Oscar and Valeria, who drowned crossing the Rio Grande. A photograph of their bodies went viral, sparking outrage, sparking grief, but also sparking what we now know as trutherism. There was a post in the I'm 1015 Border Patrol Facebook group charging that this photograph was a fake, doctored, invented. And so my poem is a response to that photograph and these charges. Floaters is a term used by the Border Patrol to describe those who have drowned crossing over. And it's not the only pejorative term they use, but we'll leave it at that and get into the poem. And it does have an epigraph.
Yeah.
Floaters. Epigraph. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and ask, have y'all ever seen floaters this clean? I'm not trying to be an ass, but I have never seen floaters like this. Could this be another edited photo? We've all seen the Dems and liberal parties do some pretty sick things. anonymous post I'm 1015 Border Patrol Facebook group. Like a beer bottle thrown into the river by a boy too drunk to cry. Like the shard of a styrofoam cup drained of coffee brown as the river. Like the plank of a fishing boat broken in half by the river, the dead float. And the dead have a name. Floaters, say the men of the Border Patrol, keeping watch all night by the river, hearts pumping coffee as they say the word floaters, soft as a bubble, hard as a shoe, as it nudges the body to see if it breathes, to see if it moans, to see if it sits up and speaks. And the dead have names, a feast day parade of names, names that dress all in red, names that twirl skirts, names that blow whistles, names that shake rattles, names that sing in praise of the saints. Say, Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say, Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. See how they rise off the tongue, the calling of bird to bird somewhere in the trees above our heads, trilling in the dark heart of the leaves. Say what we know of them now they're dead. Oscar slapped dough for pizza with oven-blistered fingers. Daughter Valeria sang, banging a toy guitar. He slipped free of the apron he wore in the blast of the oven, sold the motorcycle he would kick till it sputtered to life, counted up pesos for the journey across the river, and the last of his 25 years, and the last of her 23 months. There is another name that beats its wings in the heart of the trees. Say, Tanya Vanessa Avalos, Oscar's wife and Valeria's mother, the witness stumbling along the river. Now their names rise off her tongue, say, Oscar y Valeria. He swam from Matamoros across to Brownsville. The girl slung around his neck, stood her in the weeds on the Texas side of the river, swore to return with her mother in hand, turning his back as fathers do, who later say, I turned around, and she was gone. In the time it takes for a bird to hop from branch to branch, Valeria jumped in the river after her father. Maybe he called out her name as he swept her up from the river. Maybe the river drowned out his voice as the water swept them away. Tanya called out the names of the saints, but the saints drowsed in the stupor of birds in the dark, their cages covered with blankets. The men on patrol would never hear their pleas for asylum, watching for floaters, hearts pumping coffee all night on the Texas side of the river. No one, they say, had ever seen floaters this clean. Oscar's black shirt yanked up to the armpits, Valeria's arm slung around her father's neck. Even after the light left her eyes, both face down in the weeds back on the Mexican side of the river. Another edited photo. See how her head disappears in his shirt, the waterlogged diaper bunched in her pants, the blue of the blue cans. The radio warned us about the crisis actors we see at one school shooting after another. The man called, Oscar, will breathe, sit up, speak, tug the black shirt over his head, shower off the mud, and shake hands with the photographer. Yet, the floaters did not float on a Rio Grande like Olympians showing off the backstroke, nor did their souls float up to Dallas, land of rumored jobs and a president shot in the head as he waved from his motorcade. No bubbles rose from their breath in the mud, light as the iridescent circles of soap that would fascinate a 2-year-old. And the dead still have names, names that sing in praise of the saints, names that flower in blossoms of white, a cortege of names dressed all in black, trailing the coffins to the cemetery. Carve their names and headlines and gravestones they would never know in the kitchens of this cacophonous world. Enter their names in the book of names. Say, Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say, Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. Bury them in a corner of the cemetery named for the sainted Archbishop of the Poor, shot in the heart saying mass, bullets bought by the taxes I paid when I worked as a bouncer and fractured my hand 40 years ago, and bumper stickers read, El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. When the last bubble of breath escapes the body, may the men who speak of floaters, who have never seen floaters this clean, float through the clouds to the heavens where they paddle the air as they wait for the saint who flips with the keys on his ring like a drowsy janitor till he fingers the key that turns the lock and shuts the gate on their babble-tongued faces, and they plunge back to earth, a shower of hailstones pelting the river, the Mexican side of the river.
Thank you, Martin. This poem operates like an enraged and a soothing litany, you know, enraged at the desecration piled upon these beautiful people, tragically who died, with two of them, Oscar and Valeria, and honoring Tanya as well. I wonder if you could talk about the kind of joint energies of outrage and dignifying that pulse through this poem.
Well, to be sure, there is rage, but the point, as far as a poet is concerned, is to channel that rage creatively, to channel the anger into art. Otherwise, it simply becomes rhetoric, it simply becomes polemic, and I want to avoid that at all cost. As far as dignity, it's an extremely important impulse here. This is a matter of humanizing the dehumanized. Dehumanization, certainly with respect to immigrants in this country, is a prerequisite to barbarity. And what's being done to immigrants in this country to this day is certainly barbaric. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not confined to this country. The backlash against migrants is something happening all over the Western world.
Yes. Each time I read this poem, I'm so moved by the references to flowers and birds, beautiful things that are called to mind in the middle of a poem that's describing such atrocity. How does it feel for you to bring the tenderness of one thing into a poem and to channel the rage into something that can be as tender as flower and bird song?
Well, the tenderness is equally important as the rage. There is no poem in this case without the tenderness. Without the tenderness which the people in the poem display to one another, the family in question, without the tenderness of the world surrounding them as a terrible counterpoint, all they want is what the world has to offer. Mm. That's why they were trying to cross the river.
Yeah. I'm going to move on to talk about some poems, some other poems. You write often about both of your parents in different poems. And I wonder if you could tell us their names and a little bit about what they were like as people.
Well, my father, Francisco Luis Espada, Frank Espada, was a community organizer, an activist, a leader, some would say the leader of the Puerto Rican community in New York City in the 1960s and early 70s. He was also and primarily remembered as a documentary photographer. He photographed the civil rights movement, of which he was a part, and later created something called the Puerto Rican Diaspora Documentary Project, the photo documentary and oral history of the Puerto Rican migration. And his work is now in many major collections, Smithsonian Museum of American History, the Smithsonian Art Museum, National Portrait Gallery, Library of Congress, and so on. That's my father. You want to hear about my mother, too?
Yeah, we all want to hear about her.
All right. Okay, well, my mother is still very much with us. My mother is 95 years old, which bodes well for me, I would say. She was born Jewish in Brooklyn and became a Jehovah's Witness when I was very, very young. She is still a Jehovah's Witness, so make of that what you will. Mm-hmm. What they both had in common, I would say, above all, was a sense of humor. They were funny. Mm. They were funny people.
Lovely.
They both had a sense of justice. My father's sense of justice was public, was on the street. Mm. My mother's sense of justice was more private. Mm.
And both senses seem to flow through you. I'm sure that's both a gift and a complication in that way, to have such magnificent commitments from both parents.
It's complicated.
Yeah. You have a poem called Look at This. I'd love if you could read it for us.
Sure. Look at this. My father spoke. Look at this, he said to me. We were walking through an alley from somewhere to somewhere else in Brooklyn. In front of us, a man with white hair and white beard reached into a dumpster, plucked out a bag of potato chips, stuffed his arm up to the elbow in the bag, let it flutter to the pavement at his feet, and shuffled ahead. Look at this, my father said again. Sometimes he would repeat himself. He walked up behind the white-haired man, called, Good morning, sir. So the other man wheeled around to see us, shook his hand, and left a $20 bill in the handshake, all without slowing down. We never spoke of it again. The day we left Brooklyn, he drove away so fast he left a stack of his 78s in the closet of the apartment in the projects. Look at this, was all he said, and all he had to say. Look.
Thank you. I was keen to have, you know, the poem Floaters and then this read one after the other, because what so concerns both of them is this powerful word, truth, to tell the truth in the Floaters poem and to see the truth and to bear witness to the truth in the injunction of your father, look at this. Could you talk to us about how you, as a poet and as a social activist, and as an agitator for justice and as a poet who sings of beauty, could you talk to us about truth as it guides your poems?
Well, truth is a weighty word and a subjective one, obviously. This poem is about the place where your personal truth begins. It begins first by looking, and then by seeing. When we look, what do we see? When we look, what do we see? My father taught me not only how to look, but how to see. And he did that as a father, as an activist, and as an artist. Remember, I grew up in a household with an activist artist. To me, this was as natural as breathing. And so it was quite literally a matter of learning how to look and how to see. That's where the truth began for him and for me.
Yeah. And in an era where, you know, the the possibility of our politicians speaking truth is one where there is decreasing hope. How is it that you bring yourself to thinking about truth in public language and truth by those who hold office?
Well, I vote. I hold my nose when I vote, but I do participate. Mm. Having said that, I define politics broadly. Mm. I don't define it simply in terms of going into the voting booth once every 2 years or once every 4 years, as the case may be. And too often we define our politics that way very narrowly. Who are we going to vote for? Who are we going to vote against? Mm. Certainly in our case, in the discussion around the person in the White House. So that to me is where the poetry comes in. Mm. And I mean poetry in the broadest sense as well. Looking around and observing both the politics and the poetics of our lives, because it's all there right at the elbow, right next to us.
I another question for you before we hear a poem. Your poetry is marked by a simple clarity of language, which I think it's very difficult to be very clear. It takes a lot of work to be simple. And you bring such elegance of music and seeing and tenderness and love and hope in the context of the poems, where often you're describing the world as it is rather than a fantasized world. How is it that you tune yourself towards simple language that is filled with a history of poetry, filled with form, filled with deep references to long schools of poetry, but never in a way that's just trying to emulate being clever? You are clever, but that's not the point of your poems. Your poems are ones with heart and doors open for participation. Could you talk a little bit about that really hard-won style of your work?
Well, first of all, I strive for an aesthetic of clarity, which, as you point out, is deceptively difficult to do. It means asking myself whether or not I am communicating the information that the audience needs without me standing there. I'm not always going to be there to explain my poems to people as I am doing today. Mm. I want the poem to stand on its own two feet, so to speak. So I do strive for an aesthetic of clarity. I want to communicate. I want to be understood. Having said that, over the years, that clarity has evolved into something else as well, because now along with the clarity, there is musicality. Mm. And something that was not all that important to me when I started out. And now I am listening to the music of the words right along with paying attention to what the words have to say.
Are you a voracious editor of your work, or do you spend a long time before you write the sentence so that it's essentially edited as it comes out? How do you go about that?
Oh, I do both.
Okay.
As you can tell just by hearing the poems, sometimes there's quite a bit of reading and research that goes into them.
Yeah.
The poem Floaters, I was doing quite a bit of reading beyond what the media in this country was providing, beyond the New York Times or the Boston Globe. I found myself reading sources coming from El Salvador in Spanish.
Yeah.
There was a lot of reading and a lot of thinking before the poem happened. On the other hand, once the poem begins to happen, I have to allow it to take it where it goes, and sometimes it goes to places where I had no idea it would go. Mm. And if I'm going to surprise the reader, I have to start off by surprising myself.
I think we're going to have time just for one more poem, Martin, and I wonder if we could finish with Breve Pausa. We're back to a poem that's dedicated to people who you're introducing us to.
Yes. Well, as I may or may not have made clear previously, I am Puerto Rican from New York. My father was born in Puerto Rico, and so I have a deep concern for the island and its politics and its history. It is a colonial history. Puerto Rico is the oldest colony in the world, 4 centuries under Spain, and now more than a century under the United States, taken as a prize of war in the Spanish-American War of 1898. In the 20th century and beyond, there have been those who resisted and those who were punished for their resistance. One such person was a poet by the name of Juan Antonio Corregel, as well as his wife Consuelo Le Tapia. And so this is a poem about them. And the poem is based on a photograph. So I guess you could say it's ekphrastic. But it's called Breve Pausa for Juan Antonio Corregel and Consuelo Le Tapia. In the photograph, the poet leans over to kiss his wife. He wears a black suit and a black tie, as if there will be a ceremony and a medallion hung around his neck. His hair is white and crowns the back of his head. Her hair is white in waves. She lifts her face to kiss him through his white mustache. This is a despedida. They are kissing goodbye. The charge is conspiracy again. The officers, born years after his first incarceration, lead him away to Castillo de Ponce. The officers lead her away to the women's prison at Vega Alta. The evidence is in the poetry. As the convoy of the Empire's army rumbles in the dark past the mountain town where one day they will be buried side by side, the poet says to his beloved, Esta es pausa para el amor. Es solo breve pausa. The poet watches her sleep. This is a pause for love. It's only a brief pause.
Thank you. It seems to me that the way that you have written that poem in response to that beautiful photograph, well, I feel like I can see the photograph, first of all, from the way that you bring us to it. It seems like both of these people are inflamed by the power of poetry, by the power of art, even in the face of persecution and even in the face of ongoing colonization. What is it that you propose to people who come to your classes and who read your work and who are tuning their hearts to poetry, that poetry can do for people as we work for social justice?
Well, it's difficult to quantify, and I point that out to my students, that the impact of poetry cannot be weighed, measured, boxed, labeled. Don't expect that. Yeah. Don't expect poetry to start the revolution next week. Having said that, to return to my professor Herbert Hill at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, he used to say, ideas have consequences. Mm. That was probably his favorite phrase. Ideas have consequences. So we take this poem, like the one I just read to you, and put it up into the air that we breathe, that we take it all in, and something happens. Mm. And we wouldn't do this if we didn't have that belief, that deep-founded belief that something will happen. And certainly they believe that in this poem. Of course, they derive that grand, intimate gesture, that kiss from poetry, and the power of poetry, but also the power of their belief that one day will be a different world, and they will be remembered as having played their part in making it so.
What a beautiful place to end. Martin Espada, many thanks to you from all of us here at Greenbelt.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I hope you can hear the cheers.
Again, I'll have to take the word for it.
Thank you from all of Poetry Unbound for the witness and art of your work. We are so grateful for your time.
Thank you again, Mark.
Thanks, everyone.
Greenbelters, could you please show your appreciation to Padraig too for curating that conversation? Padraig and Martin, a real reminder to us today that words matter. They really matter. And you have brought us beautiful words into the field this afternoon. So thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.